Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
To speak with Sharon or our guest, the phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All right, to Nashville. Sharon Kay is all up in the house. I'm mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88, WFSK, Historic Fisk University. And, you know, X, I didn't even ask you in the first hour, how you doing?
I'm well.
That is just
excellent.
I never do that, right? I always ask you on the front end. I'm well. I'm just superb and glad it's not raining.
Yeah, I know.
Because this weather's been rough.
And I'm glad they're finally getting around to repairing some of those potholes out
there. Oh, my God. They have been popping
especially
up like crazy, man. And it's at night you can't see them. You know, they kind of pop up on you and you're like, oh, my God, you know, tear up my car. And some of them are certainly worse than others. But I don't think they can get out there quick enough. You know, I'm just, because new ones have developed in the last, you know, since the last couple weeks of all this rain we've had. And chances for rain are back, but the temps are up. And that's a good thing. The temps are up. For us, you know, above freezing during the daytime, way above for sure. But I think it won't be long here before we'll be like say hello to spring. The 1st of March is Friday. Woo woo.
Yeah, it is.
And you know, the Easter Bunny and all that, and Resurrection Sunday is coming, and you know everything, and you know then flowers start to blooming and carrying on, and you know, and then young hearts, you know, run free and fall in love, and ain't there a song out there about that kind of stuff? And you all keep that in mind, because you know we're still dealing with these flooding issues that have been giving us headaches in this region now for a couple of weeks. So the advisories are going to continue, and then if we get a 40% chance for more rain, that Cumberland River is, everybody's got all eyes on that thing, because it is definitely has risen just dramatically. And as I make this statement, why is there a park there? I never got that. Okay, I'm just asking the question. It just seems like a crazy place. But anyway, I wasn't here for that discussion. But it just seems like it's underwater a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
It is, you know. Maybe if it was a boat ramp or something, you know, versus what it actually is. But if you are out and about later on tonight, we have a flood warning in effect for areas around that Cumberland River at Dover and Clarksville and around the Omohundro Water Plant here in Davidson County. And the levels are running high and will likely remain that way throughout the weekend. And additionally, the warning is till further notice. And at 8 o'clock this morning, the stage at the river was 41.5 feet and steady. And that's pretty much how it's looking for us. And that means that at 41 feet, flooding along the river begins from the Cumberland River, Greenway Bridge, and Shelby Bottoms Park to the I-24 bridge near downtown. This includes the ball fields and other areas in Shelby Bottoms Park and properties adjacent to the river on Davidson Street, Nestor Street, and Bisco Drive. Backwater effects also begin to cause flooding on Mill Creek up to near Lebanon Pike. So the usual spots where we generally see the backup, the flooding, is where they will continue to be a problem for us here in the mid-state area. Now, I'm certain that all eyes today... Oh, wait a minute. Let me get the low for tonight so you'll know. Tonight about 42, tomorrow 50, and we're back to having chances for rain. So we did have a couple of days of dry out. Tomorrow 50% chance for rain, high at 50. And then we just kind of stay in the 50s and have chances for rain throughout the rest of the week. So it's back to umbrellas again. But right now we have clouds and 67 degrees in Nashville. It's still quite warm. It's this warm for, you know, right now. Anyway, X, I know all eyeballs today, or a lot of them, were on the hearings today.
Yeah, that's true.
And I know I watched. Some people wanted more excitement.
Yeah,
you know,
cool.
Some people wanted high stakes drama and all that kind of stuff. And oh, I didn't do this. And rah, 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 rah.
I wanted a smoking gun.
Oh, did you?
Like, boom. Here it is right here. Bam. This.
Well, that's not the
this.
Way these things work,
know.
You know. It's like you have to keep watching, you know. 20 episodes, you know, to get to that. But I think, you know, because we are that kind of nation, that we wanted lickety-split.
Yeah.
Give it to me quick.
Yeah.
But there's so many investigations that need to happen.
From the looks of it, they are.
Well, praise the Lord. About time.
I think the writing's on the wall for Donald J. Trump.
Well, we'll have to see.
It is.
You know, as the world turns.
His worst nightmare is his hometown of New York.
Well, we'll have to see. Because he's been doing that dance, the New York shuffle, for years.
Anymore.
And he hadn't gone to jail yet.
Not anymore.
Oh, okay.
Anymore.
So you're saying House of Cards is collapsing.
It's done. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, well.
When they indict your...
Everybody.
The person,
yeah, everybody.
Well, more importantly, the person who's been handling, when they give immunity to the person who's been handling the finances of your livelihood, your organization, everything, I don't know how you get out of that.
Well,
when that person gets immunity.
Well, all I know is how do you get out of all this lifetime of craziness this man has done?
So, that right there,
it was really something today to hear various and sundry things. You know, some people wanted, like you wanted the drop the load, and, you know, some was like, it's boring. Yeah.
But he couldn't. You know. I think it's obvious that all that evidence that Mueller has that, and, you know. So.
Well, and during the portions that you watched and then the portions I watched, I noticed how the differing sides asked the questions. I saw our own Congressman Cooper on that.
Yes, we did. Yes,
and
we
I
did.
Thought his questions were interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
When he talked about the impact and things of that nature, I thought that was quite interesting. And how different the hearing was when the Dems are leading it versus the Republicans. It's like an old boy, old girls club in there.
Yeah.
It's like a frat party, you know, like, we got your back, baby. We got you. But I'm glad the questions were answered and people had an opportunity to, you know, find out about some things. There was a lot that came out as a result of today. But I think that anybody who continues to say that the president doesn't lie or is not doing hook and crook is just literally in a state of denial like crazy. They just are.
Yeah. I don't. You
when the crookedest people in the room tell you that they're crooked.
You mentioned it earlier, and I'm just, we couldn't find an answer as to why Republicans continue to cover for a person who is doing them no good. No good. At all.
They insist on going down with the ship. They insist on going down.
It makes more sense to, you know, go ahead and get rid of him and swear Mike Pence in and salvage some of your party. To me, that just makes sense.
Ken's got to go too.
Yeah, well, yes, that's true. But he doesn't deserve to. But in the short term, you're better off politically to get things done.
Now, they're not
with the Pence.
Now, when I mentioned that to you, you know, earlier, you know I have gone into my deep thought mode.
It just makes no sense.
Because what I said to you was, I, for the life of me, don't know at what point these people actually are going to wake up from this coma-like
state. Yeah.
I just, you know, it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I'm like, what? You all know, I mean, you've got common sense. You see that the man is a crook. Why do you keep protecting him? Wouldn't it just be better for your party and the nation and the world to go ahead and move, let Donald Trump go on and take care of his business, get Pence in there for the short term that he'll have in there to try to legislate and get things back on some sort of keel, and then worry about 2021, 2020. You know, it just makes sense to me, but I just, you know, it makes no sense to me. You know the man is under investigation for his taxes. You know, he's under investigation
for everything. Okay?
And he's still continuing to try to support
there's like
this.
Nothing that
it's
this
ridiculous.
Cat is not in trouble for.
This from the party of people who wanted to know about Benghazi and Hillary's emails.
In the American way.
It just makes no sense.
Well, I'm just like, I'm like, well, Lord, I know that eventually they will wake up, come around.
Don't. Yeah.
But some,
stay on the road.
Yeah. I mean, but some, you know, everybody has to determine.
There's another election coming.
You know, like when you're in a relationship, you know, just how far you're going to go with them.
Yeah.
If they, you know, go to the point of no return.
Trump. Go ahead. Stick with Trump.
Then, you know, that's up to them.
It'd be easier for
us. That's up to them.
Stick with Trump.
I'm just
write them out to the very
there
end.
There is so much here that I am like, Lord. Yeah. How could you possibly?
If I'm in Kentucky, if I'm a Democrat, I'm raising money right now to move Mitch McConnell right on out of the way. Just get rid of him and quite a few others. Just Ted Cruz and Ted. It's time for them to move.
Because
you all stood by. Yep.
There were some things that I heard today about wanting to inflate the value of himself to buy the Buffalo Bills.
Yeah.
I'm like, that was interesting.
And that's, he did a lot of, we talked about inflating the property of his values.
Everything.
I mean, the value of his properties.
Everything. Things from the banks to everybody.
The banks,
just a lie.
Deutsche Bank. Or illegal.
Lie.
Illegal.
It's just like, man, you just lied about everything. No wonder you talk about the size of everything.
Yeah.
But something else that, and you know, I'm saying to white America, and I talk to y'all all the time, just like I talk to black America and brown America and yellow America. Because you know one black person does not mean a thing.
He's not a racist. Hey, come here. See her? She works for the Trump Organization. Now, how are you going to call him a racist?
Oh, my.
A black person working
when
there.
They did that one. I was like, Lord, please help me. Deliver me, Father. Because that's one of the, you know.
Implicit bias?
That's one of the sure ways of telling. We only have one.
Yeah.
If you give us just one, we're diverse.
And the poor lady, she had no choice but to stand up there and be used.
Well, and obviously, you know, she's paid well to be there. But when they pulled that to me was the smoke.
That's
gun.
The trick, though. Yeah. She didn't have a choice.
Oh, my God.
Was she going to say no?
Her name is Lynn Patton.
Yeah, was she going to say no?
She is a high-ranking black woman in the Trump administration. And when they pulled her out to say the president isn't a racist and just said, see, he's got one, I'm like, oh, Lord, is this the gauge for you got one? And then when the congressman that made the statement, Mark Meadows, he got offended by one of the other congresspeople who was, you know, doing her questions and making her comments, he got very inflamed. And I don't know if you saw that part or not, because I think you were answering the phone or something.
Yeah.
And he got worked up because, you know, how dare you call him a racist?
Yeah.
Because he has nieces and nephews of color. Which doesn't necessarily mean they get invited to all the family functions, okay? And it doesn't mean they spend the night at your house with Uncle such and such and Auntie. I mean, just because. That does not, you know. Oh, Lord. I mean, you know, this litmus test people are using. Well, I know one black person, so therefore I can never be. No, come on now. Oh, Lord. I mean, that one just took me to a whole nother place.
But, you know, when Michael Cohen says that Donald Trump directed me to break the law with these hush money payments to which I'm going to prison for, part of the reason, blah, blah, blah. And by the way, here's a check signed by the president. Here's the date while he was in office. Mm-hmm. He signed this while in the Oval Office. Here's your proof.
Right.
And the Republicans sit there and say nothing. Not a... You know,
well, they start talking about other stuff.
Yeah, here's your proof. Here's a check from Donald J. Trump himself paying me for these payments. And I'm, by the way, I'm part of the reason why I'm going to prison. Hello?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, for them to be so sanctimonious about people lying, and they are listening to a steady stream of them all day at the White House. You know, it's the acting was just so intense. It was so intense. It was. Oh, Lord. But I think we need a bunch of hearings so we can see more of this intense acting. Because there's a lot. There's a lot. We've seen a lot, but we need to see more. And I think that they need to quit sealing them up and having them in quiet. The American people need to see what on earth is going on so we can feel good about it or not good about it and fix it if it needs to be fixed. Anyway, today was quite a long day at the hearing. So you'll be undoubtedly, if you watch the news or whatever, you'll be hearing that discussion a lot, a lot, a lot, a lot.
But you know what? The one thing that I think is coming next, one of the things is they'll be subpoenaing those tax returns.
Well, it's about time. Yeah,
that's next because
it's about time.
They spent a significant amount of time talking about his taxes and just what you talked about earlier about his properties and inflating value. And so the only way to unravel all that is to get his tax returns and take a look at it.
Well, guess who knows already?
Mueller.
The people who prepare the taxes.
Oh.
Okay, boom. Get them up there.
Oh, yeah.
That takes care of everything. Who did his taxes? Come on. Who'd you turn them into? IRS. Come on. Bring them in. That's where your testimony is. You ain't got to show me nothing. Give me the eyeballs that reviewed this. Anyway, we're coming back. Book four today is Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. Dr. Jennifer Harvey is the author and my guest, and we're going to bring her back with us in a few minutes. But first, this time out, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Want to give your opinion today? The phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
Hi, I'm Julie Mix McPeak, Commissioner for the Tennessee Department of Commerce and Insurance. The Department of Commerce and Insurance regulates insurance in Tennessee. That means more than you might think. We educate consumers, we mediate insurance-related complaints, and we enforce the state's insurance laws. An average of $3 million is returned annually to Tennessee consumers through our efforts. We will not stop advocating for you until we are satisfied you have been treated fairly by your insurance company or agent. We respond to over 3,000 insurance complaints annually. If you have a complaint, contact us today. Always use our website to look up an insurance agent's license before you buy a policy. All agents must be licensed in Tennessee to sell you an insurance policy. We are experts on insurance, so we can explain your options and answer your questions. We protect Tennessee consumers every day, and we want to help you. For more information, visit tn.gov/commerce.
Brought to you by the Department of Commerce and Insurance in cooperation with the Tennessee Association of Broadcasters.
Support for What's the 411 is being brought to you by Integrity Dental Care. Are you happy with your smile? Are you starting to see bad results from smoking, drinking, bad foods, or soft drinks? Integrity Dental Care would love to help you get your smile back. We do general checkups, cleanings, whitening, and take care of cavities. Consultations are free because Dr. Jacqueline Mitchell wants you to leave better than you came. At Integrity Dental Care, we treat you with integrity and not as a number. All insurances are accepted, including TennCare and Cover Kids. We're located at Southern Hills Hospital, Suite 314, Building C, and can be reached at 615-445-8700 or online at integritycares.com. Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
To speak with Sharon or our guest, the phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All right, in Nashville, Sharon Kay is in the house. Mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88 WFSK Historic Fisk University on this last Wednesday in the month of February, Black History Month. The book this hour is written by Dr. Jennifer Harvey. She's an author, speaker, and professor at Drake University. Now, Dr. Harvey's work focuses on racial justice and white anti-racism, and she has also penned other books. Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in the one we'll be talking about today, In a Racially Unjust America, and Dear White Christians, for those still longing for racial reconciliation. So, Dr. Jennifer Harvey, we're happy to have you with us today. How are you?
I'm good today, Ms. Kay. Thank you so much for having me.
You are welcome. Now, where is Drake University?
We're in Des Moines, Iowa.
Oh, wow.
The polar vortex is alive and well.
Yeah, you all have to have shovels and the snow blowers and the whole nine yards up there.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yes.
So are you, how many feet are on the ground now?
Well, you know what? It's more than 30 inches, and in some spots where you've shoveled and thrown snow, it's, 4 feet, but it's so cold, it's not melting.
Oh, wow. That's love for where you are.
Yes, it's something.
Yeah, oh, no question about it. So you have plenty of time to sit in the warm house and write books.
That's right, I do, right.
Now, I am very much looking forward to having you on because, number one, I feel like the time has more than come to discuss this topic, and the conversation needs to be had. With white America needs to have it, and we're always the ones, black folks are always the people sitting around having all these conversations when the person who really needs it is not saying a thing.
Yes.
So I'm happy to have you with us today to talk about the book. Now, your foreword is written by a or introduction, one of them is written by, no, it's your foreword, by a former guest. He's been on the show about five or six times, our dear buddy Tim Wise.
Yes.
And he's a Nashvilleian. And, he speaks very boldly on this subject. How long have you known Tim?
You know, I've known his work for a very long time. Mm-hmm. I've only actually personally met him myself in the last year or so.
Yeah.
Though I actually don't even know him well as a friend, but I certainly know his work very well.
Yeah. Well, and I would say, I guess it had to be inspirational to have a white guy talking about issues of race and color as boldly as he has.
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think that, as you said already, you know, people of color, communities of color, break silence about racism all the time. And it's, you know, that's still the landscape. There's so few white Americans that do so such that when somebody does it and does it well and with courage and truthfulness, it's really important. And it is inspiring. It helps galvanize other white Americans to, you know, both relearn and learn to speak more boldly ourselves.
Is this because of fear of what's going to happen, or is this a myth or a misconception? What makes, or they just hope that nobody notices this? I mean, tell me so I can learn a little bit more.
Well, I think there's a few different things. I mean, it's certainly there's a level of fear that white Americans have that if, you know, we speak and call other white folks out about racism or expose ourselves as holding on to racist beliefs, that it's not going to go well or we're not going to do it correctly. And that's, you know, I'm not defending that fear. It's nothing compared to what people of color live with in terms of the actual impact of racism. But I think that sometimes is what goes on. But I do think that there's something true, and the reason I, you know, found myself writing about parenting, much to my surprise, is that a piece for some white Americans is that so few of us were raised to learn the language of racism and anti-racism, to be developmentally challenged and supported in understanding what it means for us as white Americans. And so we have not had the sort of adult parenting and caregiving around anti-racism that many times, you know, African Americans are actively, you know, engaging their own children and their own nieces and nephews and grandchildren in anti-racism by net virtue of necessity. And so white Americans just sometimes literally are, you know, I compare it to, we're doing calculus by the time we're age 20, whereas African Americans are doing, I mean, we're doing addition while African Americans are doing calculus because nobody taught us math. And that's a real challenge. It's not the only reason that white Americans don't do it, but it is a piece of the puzzle, I think, for some white families.
So what's the real reason why? Is it denial? I mean, come on.
Well, certainly denial, yes. I mean, absolutely. There's, you know, white folks deny that racism is real.
Sure.
I mean, that's, some white Americans just, you know, flatly deny it exists. Others who would acknowledge that it exists don't, you know, have a sense of urgency about it because it's not our children that are being shot in the streets. And so, again, I'm not defending that, but I think that is a piece of what goes on. But, you know, and so, I mean, there's, you know, different reasons for different white Americans. Some white Americans don't want to give up power. Lots of white Americans don't want to give up power. I'm not naive about white resistance for sure. There's lots of, you know.
Is it a giving up of power or is it a sharing of the power? Because you're still going to have it. The white America will still have the power, so, you know, they might as well quit thinking that they're never going to have it. Cause I think that's part of what keeps everybody bound down. Is, oh my God, whatever. I mean,
it's a sharing of power in truth, right? It just feels to white Americans sometimes that it's this sort of loss. But in fact, in my own journey and experience in spaces where there's robust multiracial justice seeking, it's life-giving and liberating to be in those spaces. And so, I mean, it's a malformed way of seeing the world for sure.
Mm-hmm. So your book helps people who have, they feel like their consciousness is awakened a little bit, and they want to make sure that they're raising a generation of their children, white communities, not to be so bigoted and prejudiced and full of all the craziness that they might have grown up with themselves?
I would even say, my book is not for folks, I'm not trying to convince other white folks about racism, but it's for white folks who are already convinced of its existence and who are trying to figure out how you take that awareness and parent and raise children in a way that is not only actively works against and teaches against bigotry, but also actively cultivates anti-racism as a way of living in the world. I mean, that's a practice and a skill set and a commitment that we need to cultivate in our children, but it doesn't happen by magic. We have to actually really mentor and teach them.
Now, in your very first chapter here, From Color Blindness to Race Conscious Parenting, now, do these race-conscious parents have to have be of a mixed relationship or have a mixed somebody in the family or, you know, what brings the awakening and when is the right time?
Well, I don't know what brings awakening, but the right time is from birth and wherever somebody lives and whether or not you have multiracial relationships. I mean, white parents can and need to start teaching their kids about race immediately.
Right.
And sometimes we're more inclined to do that if we already have meaningful interracial relationships ourselves, because we are then more aware in embodied ways of the stakes and the urgency. But, for different white Americans, the awakening to realize we have a crisis that we haven't done our part in is different.
Now, you speak on page 49. I hope you have your book close by you.
I can pull one out.
Okay. A quick word about diversity. You write, race-conscious parenting is different than simply teaching our children. They should value diversity and difference. To me, that sort of played out today in the hearings, Cohen hearings today, when they... when he had said, you know, made the statements, the president's a racist, and then the congressman pulls out the one black lady.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, I was like, please, y'all don't ever do that again, okay?
Yeah.
You know, come on. Is that...
That's right.
Okay. Am I right on that? I mean, come on.
Oh, yes. Oh, please. I mean, that was just... If you wanted to prove how racist you were, do that. Say, oh, here's the one black person, right?
And she happens to have daddy from Birmingham, you know. I'm like, oh, Lord, y'all could not have done. You know, if you would have said her grandfather was a civil rights activist, I would have laid over on this floor.
Oh,
my
God.
Right. Oh, my. Lord help me, Father. How dare you talk about him? I was like, oh, go on, sit down, girl.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and at the same time, there was, you know, I think yesterday or the day before, the other young lady who worked on the campaign, who now has decided to, file charges or to speak out against him when she worked strong for the campaign for a couple of years and now is not. And that's a black woman who was pro-Trump. So, I mean, that does not... Where does that litmus test come from? Is that some old whiteness from way back? I mean, where do you get that?
Oh, sure. I mean, that claim and that trope is so ancient that it's as if somehow, I mean, during the period of enslavement, when white Americans were enslaving African peoples and people of African descent, the sort of claim that closeness meant you were a kind and good person, you know, was repeated all over the place. So, I mean, that's a deeply embedded racist myth in the white American psyche.
Right. Now, and that's, I guess, some of it is the stuff that's been passed on from generation to generation.
Yeah.
And people still living off of that.
Yeah.
And no, they have had no personal growth themselves.
Yeah.
Is it because they have enjoyed privilege for so long that is all they know, period? Just, is that it?
You know, again, I think it's different for different folks, but I certainly think that's a piece of it, because when you've kind of feasted on, you know, hoarding resources that you have unjustly had access to, and you think that that's normal, and you live in a society that is still deeply, deeply segregated, so you rarely have to be in, you know, human-to-human relationships with the very people and communities that you're unjust hoarding is impacting,
yeah.
you know, there's a deforming of the consciousness that is really profound, and that has to be actively interrupted, reshaped every single day, because, I mean, it runs so deep.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, also, really, the president needs a copy of this book.
yeah, he needs a lot of things.
I know. I was just saying, because I'm on page 81. Yeah, he does need a lot. And a whole team of them, too, okay?
Yes, he does.
But on page 81, you say, speaking and modeling race-conscious postures does not mean making vague generalizations about groups. So comments like S-hole countries and, I mean, just some of the stuff that, you know, has been said and, you know, thighs like cantaloupes or whatever. I mean, you know, this stuff is just so screaming. Why would a white person not think that there's something wrong with that? Because they have always thought like that or been trained or grew up like that or what?
Yeah, I mean, I think how people get trained and get brought up is a piece of it. Although, you know, at a certain point in one's life, regardless of how you've been brought up, you are also morally responsible for beliefs you actively maintain. And so, you know, I think, you know, the formation not only in the home, but also in the society that we live in, where white folks walk around the United States every day and in all these spaces where we get fed false notions of our superiority and false notions of the inferiority of other groups, and without actively undoing that and actively intervening in it, those beliefs can easily just persist.
So if folks are sitting around and in their homes or their social circles and shooting all this stuff back and forth, then the kids are sitting there listening to it, well, quite naturally, they're going to absorb it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And even in, you know, in homes where white families claim to be teaching their children everybody's equal, or we all, you know, we need to love everyone the same, part of what also happens is in white families, so much racism happens in white family networks, and kids watch their adults in their lives, or, you know, aunts and uncles, be silent when racism happens, right? Don't interrupt racism when grandpa's saying it. And so what kids are told is, oh, we value equality, but then they watch adults that they trust not challenge racism when they see it, and so they end up concluding, well, you know, the best thing you should do is be silent when you encounter racism. And so, I mean, kids do what they see as much or more as what they are told. And so those behaviors that white adults manifest are really impactful.
Now, when we come back from the break, Dr. Harvey, I want you to go into Where Do I Start? And, you know, you have one of my favorite cartoons, Dr. McStuffins, in here.
Yes, okay.
I love her. I'm like, okay, we got to talk about Dr. McStuffins.
Let's talk about Dr. McStuffins.
Some of y'all have a problem with her. You need to get over it. And next, I know you got to make a comment. You have a question or comment out there in radio land. Y'all know it's you. Our number is 615-329-8810, 615-329-8810. Today's book, Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. We're taking the time out, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Want to give your opinion today? The phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810.
But for What's the 411 is being brought to you by Integrity Dental Care. Are you happy with your smile? Are you starting to see bad results from smoking, drinking, bad foods, or soft drinks? Integrity Dental Care would love to help you get your smile back. We do general checkups, cleanings, whitening, and take care of cavities. Consultations are free because Dr. Jacqueline Mitchell wants you to leave better than you came. At Integrity Dental Care, we treat you with integrity and not as a number. All insurances are accepted, including 10 care and cover kids. We're located at Southern Hills Hospital, Suite 314, Building C, and can be reached at 615-445-8700 or online at integritycares.com.
Still clearing a crash with injuries on 24 East near Bell Road and the crash on Bell Road crossing Stewart's Ferry Pike in Donelson. The eastern split is still slowed. A wreck on I-40 East at Fessler's has just been cleared on the right-hand side. This traffic report is brought to you by ICUSecurityInc.com. I'm AJ Rose with your on-time traffic.
On the next Jazz Night in America, Orrin Evans joins the Bad Plus. Classics from their songbook and new music from the trio's first record with Orrin in the piano chair.
What should strike anyone about the Bad Plus is the fact that we are saying the Bad Plus 17 years later.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America. Catch Jazz Night in America every Sunday from 2 to 3 p.m., and Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. here at listener-supported Jazzy 88.
Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
To speak with Sharon or our guest, the phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All righty, Nashville. Sharon Kay is in the house. Mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88 WFSK Historic Fisk University and Drake University. Professor Dr. Jennifer Harvey is with me this beautiful Wednesday afternoon. And we don't have 4 feet of snow like you all do there, but we have had the rain, though, for real. 2 weeks of it, and just the showers are back in the forecast, though. But I think I'd rather get the rain than the 4 feet. I mean,
I'm vicariously loving your rain.
That's for sure. Now, Dr. Harvey's new book, Raising White Kids, is our discussion point. And ask before I go into the discussion about Dr. McStuffins. had a question.
I do. I wanted to know your opinion on how much damage do you honestly think has been done to the United States because of the office of the presidency? My example is, case in point, the young high school student who got in the face to sort of mock the Indian man who was, on his drums and chanting at that protest, and sort of the lack of respect as a young person to, first of all, do something like that, and then secondly, to pull a Trumpism by not apologizing, saying that he didn't do anything wrong, he was standing his ground, no accountability from his parents, no respect for elders, none of that. And so it sort of speaks to the overall arching thing that we see taking place because of what we see going on in the White House. So how much damage do you think is being done to our nation?
Oh, untold amounts. I mean, Trump has emboldened, I mean, the way that the needle has been moved in terms of what kind of rhetoric and behavior is quote-unquote legitimate is just appalling. And, you know, besides the way in which he's, you know, he's called neo-Nazis very fine people in Charlottesville, he's, you know, emboldened those who are already inclined to use violence to do so, you know, in ways that they, you know, they're feeling less of a sense of potential impunity. And I mean, and then the kinds of toxic messages that our kids are absorbing because it's in the airwaves and it's sort of being posited as sort of, well, there's good people on both sides when we're really talking about, you know, white supremacists and neo-Nazis. Our kids are internalizing all of that. I mean, the damage is so great.
And not just the kids, but the parents.
Yeah, well, yes, absolutely, the parents. But, you know, parents, you know, if I think about myself, I have, you know, these sort of critical thinking lenses where I'm already constantly intellectually and emotionally pushing back on that stuff. But I think about, what are my kids hearing at school that sort of, quote-unquote, normalizing discussions about walls and borders and, you know, we've got so much more, you know, interventions then to do because it's everywhere.
Yeah. Well, in addition to that, you know, the people, the one-third of America that stands behind it and believes it, I mean, that and those people that believe that and don't speak back to that ignorance, to me, are just like it.
Yeah. Or they wouldn't, it's like a moth to the flame, you know. You wouldn't be all up underneath it if you didn't feel it that way, too. I mean, some of these very people are probably teachers and executives and own companies and make decisions about people's lives.
That was a whole school. There was no rebuke of the school, per se. You know, no accountability on behalf of the teachers that should have been there, the other students,
well, as
the principal.
As the scenario, as the story unfolded, you know, as it unfolded, the Native American man was he went into the thing. He should have he was trying to bring peace.
Yeah.
And he kind of brought a little bit of that on himself. Okay. If you have to see the whole, you have to
But you know, as a
but the disrespect that
there you go.
Yeah,
you know,
I got that.
That's
But see, that's
letting him do. You know, if I'm being raised properly, then I let that adult.
But see, that's that. That's the kind of stuff that young white kids have been doing to black folks for years.
And then we can hold him accountable and say, "Sir, you should know better. You, what kind of example are you setting? You're supposed to be setting a bad a better example for the youth, but for the youth to, I mean, what? So what kind of future do they see? That's what my point.
It's
well, and can I say, I mean, Nathan Phillips, the native elder who did the drumming, you know, he, and I did watch lots of the footage and all of it and different angles, and, you know, he claims, and to me it appeared to be that he was trying to de-escalate what was a very complex and multiracial encounter that had gotten really heated. But those youths, and this was the narrative that bothers me so much, especially as I think about what I'm trying to do in this book, those youths, sort of white America suggesting that a group of white boys...
Yes.
Doing the tomahawk chop,
right,
which they were all doing, is collectively harmless. That right there tells us everything we need to know about those white socialization. Because, my 8-year-old knows that the tomahawk chop is a racist display of behavior.
Absolutely.
And we just, right there. And so, you know, it was a complicated day, but that, you know, they were whooping, they were mocking, they were... And it was racist what they were doing, but, you know, white adults don't use that language when we talk about our kids, and that's a huge problem.
Right. Well, and to me, that is something that historically has been part of the problem for a long time, because white kids, and I'm being honest, and you all know that, have never really had to respect black people or people of color.
Yes.
Because, I mean, that was just never a thing.
Yes.
So, and I hear what you're saying about the school system and all that, which, you know, to me, that was a private institution. Wasn't that a Catholic school?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Well, you know, in lies the problem. That should be part of what they teach them anyway. To, you know, have respect for their elders. But that stuff is not taught. Who teaches kids to be respectful of their elders? They're not going to... Come on, y'all. I mean, does anybody teach that anymore to your kids?
Well, I'm trying.
I know. I see you. But I mean, just period.
Yeah.
I think our society now has gotten to a point where... young people, period, don't respect authority or people in positions of authority or adults. I mean, I just think it's across the board. And more so culturally among white children. I don't see it. Now, Doc McStuffins, I said, I'm going to love Dr. Hart because you included her in this book.
She's amazing.
Yes, absolutely. And she's been on the scene now for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Doc McStuffins is black? Hush your mouth.
That's right.
What are you talking about in this section?
Well, I'm talking about, so one of the things that we know is the way kids' brains work is developmentally, all kids, not just white kids, are inclined to kind of group people and stereotype people in negative and positive ways. And so when I talk about, you know, early in kids' lives, white parents of white kids needing to talk about race and difference with them, again, the way that families of color already do with their children, I talk a little bit about doing that, but not accidentally in doing that, also sort of accidentally teaching kids to sort of stereotype people and put groups of people always together, right? So African Americans are a diverse group of peoples, and so I want my kids kids to notice and be able to talk about blackness while also not making assumptions about people just because they're black. And that's a complicated thing to get a kid to do developmentally. So I was talking about Doc McStuffins for lots of reasons, but one is because she's such a great example of a way a parent can say, hey, look, you know, there's Doc McStuffins, and she is smart, and she is carrying a stethoscope, and she's kind, and she's black, and she's a girl, and she's, you know, and describe her in all these ways that are true, noticing her blackness, because it's important and it matters, but how that's different than saying, oh, look, black people can be doctors, and using that sort of category in a way that, you know, you teach, of course, the truth that African-American people can be doctors, but without sort of triggering this sort of groupthink that kids are inclined to do anyway, and that can end up causing more negative stereotypes.
Now, and do you address this in your book, Raising White Kids? If your son or daughter has a child by or marries a person of color and then they have children, should the grandparents or, you know, when they buy toys for the new, their grandbabies, is it helpful for them to stop buying all them blonde white dolls? And, you know, if you're going to have a mixed race grandchild, you know, they're black or whatever, can they help by, you know, mixing this up a little bit, you know, getting a black and a white doll, or, you know, or something like this? Is that helpful?
Oh, it's not only helpful, it's really important. And not just for kids who might be biracial, but it's helpful for white kids, too. I mean, all of our kids should have lots and lots of dolls and media and books where people of color are represented in all different kinds of ways and are, whether it, not only just as, you know, fighting for racial justice, but also just enjoying life. And so that our kids' brains realize diversity is part of the world they live in and that it's a gift.
Well, I would love to know how many white people buy their dolls for their kids that are other colors. I think
that would be an interesting study.
Oh, yeah. Y'all call me.
I know a few, but I suspect it's not that many. But I don't know if I've ever seen a study on that. Maybe I'm gonna have to look for that.
Yeah, definitely. I want to know for sure. Yeah, that's really something right there. Now back to the Doc McStuffins thing. There was at first, you know, not acknowledged like it should have been.
Yeah.
You know, she was professional, she was smart, you know, she did a lot of things, but, you know, that's kind of, you know, it took people a while to get used to her. So
yes.
Are they officially used to her now?
Well, so I don't know. I think actually that's the other reason I was writing about her, is because I was pretty critical. Even her producer said of Doc McStuffins, oh, you know, it's good because black girls can see in her a role model, but for other kids, they don't even notice her color. And I was like, okay, there we go again. Like, assuming that it's good, first of all, it's not true that other non-black children don't see color. And second of all, it's not good if they don't see color. Her color is beautiful, and it should be talked about. And so, yeah, I think we have a problem when we think that only black girls, for example, need to see and embrace black girl, you know, Doc McStuffins, or, you know, that, and there's this huge gap in our thinking about what all kids need to be seeing and being taught as valuable.
Yeah. Well, it's like we have to do all the work.
That's right.
I'm like, no, we don't either. This stuff needs to go 50-50 or 60-40.
I think 75-25
that
really
works
would be
for me. I'd say 80-20. That works
for white folks to step up.
Yes, Lord. Now, on page 114, you say people of color often experience white guilt as a selfish and self-indulgent emotional state. It doesn't help them in racism, and it's draining to be around. Amen.
I've been listening.
It is. We're exhausted with this stuff.
Yeah.
So in this section, this is the chapter, What Does a Healthy White Kid Look Like?
Yeah.
Tell us about this chapter.
Well, so I'm trying to help folks understand that racial development is a thing. And so I'll give you an example. White guilt, which we're, you know, very familiar with, it's actually a normal developmental stage for white people. Not, and basically because if you believe you value equality, or if you, you know, even if you really don't, but you think you do, but you start to experience a world where you are unjustly privileged.
Mm-hmm.
White guilt's a kind of normal response to that. You feel badly about that. Mm-hmm. The problem is we get stuck there, right? And so, for example, what I want is, and this has happened to an extent, I want my 7-year-old, my 8-year-old to be wrestling with guilt and, mm-hmm. and having and coming through it so that they don't spend their 20s and 30s mm-hmm. wallowing in white guilt. Mm-hmm. And so having the morally difficult conversation of, oh, if we value justice, but we're also benefiting from injustice, what do we do about that? Are there things we can do rather than just stay stuck feeling guilty about it?
Mm-hmm. Now, I ask most of the authors that just write books like yours and have these discussions with them, why does being called a racist feel like it's the worst possible thing in the world for a white person?
You know, I think it may have to do with how much the public conversation, I mean, the hearings today are case in point. We've shifted the public conversation to be clear that it's wrong and bad to be a racist. And so what white people hear when they hear get called accused of racism is like, oh, I'm a really lousy person.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum talks about it feels to white folks like getting punched in the gut. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the problem with that is that it shows how simplistic our notions of racism are, because you cannot live in the United States and breathe in racism every day mm-hmm. and not be impacted by it. That's just true that that happens. And so we're all white Americans are racist in that way. And the question is, mm-hmm. what are we doing to actively grow mm-hmm. and develop anti-racism in our lives?
Mm-hmm.
But you can't do that if you just get defensive about it.
Well, you can't do it if no one is of a very different race than you. I mean, you're everybody you know is white.
You live
in a white bubble. I mean, really?
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the problem as well. Wasn't there a survey that came out this week or last week about the percentage of people who say they have never come in contact with a person from another race?
I don't know if I saw that one. I've seen some, you know, in the last couple of years that say for white Americans it's like 90% or something.
Yeah,
outrageous.
Lord,
that's a huge problem.
Yeah. Man, they're going to have intervention from the Lord.
Something. Well, I hope, that may be what it takes. I hope we can help the Lord along, though.
Yeah. Well, that's how he does it. He'll send you down a black doctor, you know. Send you down a Hispanic EMS to help
that's
you
right.
you get in the car wreck.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's how the Lord works in mysterious ways. Now, your book is also for the community of faith, too, isn't it?
You know, it certainly is, and a lot of folks in the community of faith read it, because I'm a Christian, I'm a Baptist minister, and I do a lot of work with churches, but this particular book doesn't come from a place of assuming you have to be a Christian to engage these ideas. It doesn't write from that perspective, though it is being read in a lot of those places.
Well, Dr. Harvey, what would Jesus do, okay?
Yes. No, you know what I like to say, Ms. Kay, is if for white Americans the question is, what would Zacchaeus do? We have to give it back and pay reparations the way Zacchaeus did.
You just rocked some folks' world right there.
True.
Oh, my gosh. I enjoyed this very much.
Me too.
And, I just, you know, I'll be calling back on you because, you know, it's a good book, and I'll be following your work for sure.
Thank you. That means a lot. I appreciate it so much.
Absolutely, absolutely. And to pick up the book, find out more about your work, where's the best place to do that?
So there's a website, www.raisingwhitekids.com. You can see where to order the book. There's a free read of the introduction there. And you can follow me on Twitter at @DrJenHarvey.
Excellent. Dr. Jennifer Harvey, writer, speaker, and professor at Drake University, and we thank you so much for your time, and I'm definitely going to hang on to your number. We'll be back in touch, okay?
Thank you so much. It's been a real gift.
Absolutely.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. This would be a good read for some of you all in education. Sharon Kay, you're conjuring up. And what else is new? That's all we have for you, Nashville. That is ALLO for you tonight. You all have the very best of the best. And don't forget, who loves you?
You've been listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station and its management.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.